these, but.
I'd like to call the Jobs, Agriculture, and Rural Development Committee to order for Monday, March 24th. Thank you, members. Let the record state that we do have a quorum. It's a busy time, I know, with a second deadline quickly approaching this Friday. With us today, we have Senator Dietzick with Senate File 2695 to start things off. Senator Dietzick, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Thank you for hearing this bill. Mic up here closer. Senate File 2695 prohibits a person from labeling or advertising a plant as pollinator-friendly if the plant has been treated with a pollinator-lethal insecticide. This bill is a truth in advertising bill. You might be wondering why this is necessary. Well, more than one-third of the world's crops, including numerous fruits and vegetables, depend on bee pollination, a service worth between $15 and $20 billion a year. Wild insects and other, like flies, add another $3 billion worth of service, and this is all from the Minnesota Department of Ag report. America's food supply depends on healthy pollinators. I do have an amendment to the bill, but the bill amends, basically the bill amends Chapter 18H, which is the Nursery Law Labeling and Advertising of Nursery Stock section. Section 1 of the bill would define pollinator lethal insecticide, and then Section 2 would amend the bill, basically saying it's basically truth in advertising. You can't say that it is a pollinator-friendly plant if it is actually not a pollinator-friendly plant. With me today is Catherine Sill, and she is a hobby beekeeper. Vera, and I'm going to get it wrong, but I'll try, Chris Check from the University of Minnesota, and Christy Allen from Bee's Knees. And the Department of Ag is also here to answer any questions.
Senator Dietzick, maybe before we have your witnesses go, we'll have Senator Schmidt offer the A1 amendment to get the bill in the shape that you'd prefer.
Thank you.
All those in favor, say aye. Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? No. The motion prevails. The A1 amendment is adopted. Now, to your witnesses, whoever would like to go first, welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record.
I'm Catherine Sill. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Last summer, I was a first-year beekeeper in Minneapolis. My bees came in May, and I had a great summer tending them. They were thriving, and I found I loved everything about the hobby of beekeeping. During the summer, I made an effort to add more plants that were bee-friendly to my garden. I went to Home Depot and purchased bee balm, cone flowers, and some others. I brought them home and planted them. Imagine my surprise when I read in the paper not too long after that these plants were treated with systemic pesticides that were potentially poisonous to the very creatures I was trying to nurture. I immediately went around and beheaded the plants so there was no tainted pollen or nectar for the pollinators. I realized that the nurseries want to sell pretty plants to their customers, but one has to question at what cost to the environment. How long will these systemic pesticides stay in my garden plants? More than a year? It's possible. This bill helps everyone who wants to do the right thing by their garden, and it helps to guide the nurseries to better serve their customers. In addition to that pesticide experience, on September 12th, just 3 months after I got my bees, I went out to the hive and saw thousands of my bees were dead and dying. I called the U immediately, and they came and brought the Department of Agriculture. They took samples of the dying bees and sent them off to be tested. It turns out that I was one of three beekeepers who experienced in one day a bee kill in the same neighborhood. The results came back a few weeks later. The bees were killed by a systemic pesticide called fipronil, which is supposed to be sprayed on foundations against termites, ants, and wasps, not on flowering plants where pollinators feed. I have read as much as possible as I can about this pesticide. It's frightening that someone can randomly spray something like this, and we have no recourse, no way to find out who did it and regulate its use. I Googled it, and anyone can buy it online. A few states have banned the sale online, but not Minnesota. The outside of my hive was swabbed at the bee kill to check for sabotage, and the results came back that it was covered in a fungicide called carbendazim. So three times this summer that I know of, my bees were hit. One of the things I've learned in the last year is how complicated pesticide issues are. As with most things, I think transparency is a helpful and clarifying answer. Don't we have the right to know that the very plants we are purchasing to build a natural environment are not endangering our already fragile beneficial pollinators? Thank you.
Thank you very much. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. My name is Christy Allen. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I am the owner and beekeeper of a small business in Minneapolis called the Bee's Knees LLC. We deliver honey by bicycle. We teach in-hive classes and provide beekeeper support services at our honey house in South Minneapolis. We do all of this to raise awareness of bees and the very important role they play in our food system. Bees are responsible for pollinating many of the fruits and vegetables we consume in order to have a healthy, affordable diet. They also pollinate much of the floral landscape in and around our cities, but they are dying. Honeybee populations are suffering along with many other pollinators. University of Minnesota entomologist Dr. Marla Spivak refers to the four P's to describe the many things negatively affecting bees at the same time: pathogens, parasites, poor nutrition, and pesticides. We know the most about honeybees because we manage them, but many of our bee populations are also in danger. In order to do our work at the bee's knees, we place honeybee hives at urban farms, schools, community gardens, Minneapolis parks, and museums. We put people in bee suits, and we open up the hives so they can have a personal interaction and understanding of what bees do. The pesticide kill that we experienced last fall near Catherine Sill and a third urban beekeeper named Mark Lucas was at a school in South Minneapolis. Immediately after our bee kill, we did not know exactly how to respond. We lost our bees, the revenue that hive would have generated in honey and education sales, and we mourn the loss of our hive. In taking action, our initial impulse was to find out who did it. Who was the irresponsible person that sprayed enough pesticide to kill over 70,000 honeybees? Unfortunately, the investigation performed by the MDA did not reveal who killed our bees, but it did reveal something else. We talked to our community and formed a group called Healthy Bees, Healthy Lives. Like many groups around the country and world are doing right now concerning bees, we pooled our resources, knowledge, and expertise with one common goal: to collectively create a better place for our bees. Many people like Catherine, who thought they were helping bees by buying bee-friendly flowers, were in fact putting more pesticides harmful to bees in their landscape. This bill is the first step in giving us as consumers the right to know what we are feeding our bees. Just this past Saturday, I was selling honey at a winter farmer's market hosted by Bachman's. Over thousands of people came to that market. Many were talking about the fact that Bachman's and other major garden centers are making the choice to change practices that negatively affect bees. The public wants this choice now, and now we need the policy. Just like we need food to eat, bees need flowers to eat, but we both need it to be clean food so we don't get sick. This bill can help us choose what we are inevitably feeding our bees and everything else that is affected by what we are putting into our landscapes. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ms. Allen, for your testimony.
Mr. Chair and committee members, my name is Vera Krishik. I'm an entomologist in the Department of Entomology at the University of Minnesota. Since 1998, I've been studying systemic insecticides and how they're translocated around plants. And I'm the IPM specialist in nursery, greenhouse, and landscape. I work with all the segments of the green industry with Minnesota about these issues. And so I was asked here today to first confirm that from an application in a greenhouse, you can get levels in plants that will affect pollinators and beneficial insects. And then secondly, to reassure you that greenhouses have many different alternatives that probably would work even better in terms of integrated pest management programs. So I have provided a handout for you. It has a monarch and some bees on the bottom. And I wanted to start by opening it and reading this third page. And it says, IPM programs promote the use of multiple cultural, biological, and chemical tactics to reduce the abundance of pest insects while conserving pollinators and beneficial insects. When systemic neonicotino insecticides were first registered, their use was embraced by IPM due to their low mammalian toxicity and the use of soil applications, thereby reducing the non-target effects on beneficial insects. However, the amount and duration of neonicotino insects in pollen and nectar and their effects on beneficials was not studied. After spraying a contact insecticide, new flowers that open will not contain any residues. In contrast, systemic insecticides applied to the soil remain in the plant and they're expressed in pollen and nectar for much longer time, months up to years from a single application. Published studies in our lab demonstrated that the parasitoid, these are little tiny wasps that kill bad insects, and this is one that's used in greenhouse, Anagyrus pseudococci, and the green lacewing had altered behaviors. They couldn't forage, they couldn't kill pest insects, First they tremble and then they die. And this is from a greenhouse applied application. So what I'm saying to you is that the research supports that when you use systemic neonicotinoids in greenhouse plants, it doesn't support the use of IPM, which is to reduce pesticide use and to get good insects to conserve the bad insects. It goes on to say the pink lady beetle, when confined in mesh cages on flowers at the Como Conservatory, showed reduced survivorship and reduced movement after a soil application used greenhouse soil application used on plants at the Como Conservatory. Now, here is the information on residue, and I have to tell you that this information has been verified by the USDA lab in North Carolina that does the residue analysis for the United States. The EPA asked you to use that lab, and I've also had it done in Canada by a lab where the initial residues were done back in 1995. And what I find, the last paragraph, in Mexican milkweed, which is a plant grown in landscapes for bees and butterflies, 1X treatments, which means a label rate, resulted in 6 million parts per billion. I'm going to repeat that, 6 million parts per billion, and 2X and 10 million parts per billion. And these are also similar residues that we got 5 years earlier with buckwheat plants. And these residues killed 3 species of ladybird beetles, and the amount of residue in the leaves killed monarch and painted lady larvae. So I want to switch to this color diagram here and go over some of our data. And so the table 3 on the bottom there, it goes through what is a lethal dose and what is a dose that affects foraging of bees and ladybird beetles. And so what you come up with is around 37 parts per billion for imidacloprid. So I'm looking at the white table on the bottom. It says imidacloprid on the top of the row, and I'm going across the row to 37 parts per billion. Schmuck et al., 2001. That is a Bayer researcher who published this paper. So now if I look at the residue data that in my lab we've gotten now in many different species, and we look at agastache, which is a bee plant. It's a mint used all over Minnesota in gardens for bees and beneficial insects. The next top of the column is Asclepias, this Mexican milkweed that's used as an annual for beneficial insects. Esperanza, a pot plant that you'd grow as a container plant in your garden, and a rose. And if you look at that 37, all those numbers in orange are above 37. And if you go to the row heading 300, 1X, 600, 2X, those are what you're allowed to use. So the data is very supportive from 5 plant species that the levels of residue from a greenhouse application will kill beneficial insects. So now I'd like you to just go to the last page of the handout. And I work with the greenhouse industry. I'm coming up with recommendations for them other than systemic neonicotinoid insecticides. And I just want you to look at this: thrips, aphids, whiteflies, mites. All of these are alternative compounds that are contact insecticides. So in summary, we have a lot of insecticides that the EPA has registered over the years that have novel chemistry. The whole point in registering them was to make their use compatible with the use of beneficial insects. The systemic neonicotinoid insecticides, because they're translated to pollen and nectar, and we didn't realize at the high levels they were, and I just showed you those levels, are not compatible with IPM programs. So decreasing their use will not hurt the production of greenhouse plants. There are plenty of good alternative insecticides registered to kill pests, but they will help conserve not only bees and honeybees, bumblebees, and all those beneficial insects out there that are killing pest insects for us and thereby reducing our reliance on pesticides. Thank you.
Thank you much for your testimony. Senator Dietzick, I think that you've been working with the nurseries, and do they seem to be okay? Obviously, we can ask them to come forward, too, but is that the end of your testimony for now?
Yes, my understanding is there, and I don't see...
I can ask. Would anyone else like to be heard on Senate File 2695? Okay.
My understanding is they are okay with this.
Okay. Thank you. Further discussion, members, on Senate File 2695. Senator Daines.
Mr. Chair, and... I don't know whoever would like to answer this. How common is the usage of these insecticides that's causing this problem?
In that term.
Okay. Mr. Chair and committee members, they're very common because What they were first registered in the 1990s. Now there's five different active ingredients. And what they allow you to do is add it to the soil, apply it once, and you never have to do pest management again. So it's basically a prophylactic treatment. And really, it doesn't allow you to do IPM because you're applying pesticides that last for a long time that basically kill most greenhouse insects. So they can be commonly used, or if somebody's doing IPM, there's a lot of alternatives. So it would all depend on the grower.
Thank you. Further questions of Senator Dietzick or witnesses? If not, Senator Schmidt moves that Senate file 2695 as amended be recommended to pass. Any further discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, nay. The motion prevails. The bill is passed. Thank you, Senator Dietzick.
Thank you.
Next up, we have Senator Lori, Senate File 2060. Let's see. Senator Lori, welcome
Chair and
to
members.
The committee.
We've got Senate File 2060. I've got a A14 delete everything amendment that I'd like to offer to bring the bill into the shape, and I'd like to incorporate an A3 amendment into it as well that just adds effective dates.
Okay, they're coming out. We can do that. Then Senator Eakin will move that.
The A14 incorporating the A3.
Okay. A14 incorporating the A3 amendment. Let's let
Mr. Chair, just for the record.
Mr. Knopf, yeah. Let's
this is a revisor amendment. They're always A14. That's how they start. Just to get the, I think the whole number should be written. It's the A14-0975
okay.
amendment. And I think the what he's asking is to have the A3 amendment from our office incorporated into that and then adopted as one.
Okay. Amendment. Are members clear what that would do? Are comfortable with that? And Senator Eakin, again, will move the A14-0975 with the A3 incorporated into that. On that motion, all in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The motion prevails. The A14 amendment is adopted. Senator Lori, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. So what we have then is a farmer's market reform bill to allow beneficial uses of farmers markets around the state of Minnesota. This represents an agreement between the Minnesota Farmers Market Association, Minnesota Department of Agriculture, Minnesota Department of Health, the City of Minneapolis. Farmers Union has been integrally involved. We actually don't know of any opposition to the bill, and it would allow for farmers markets to work quite well in this upcoming season. I'll run through it real quick for you. Subdivision 1 has the definitions of what a farmer's market is, what food product sampling is, what food product demonstrations are for purposes of the bill. Subdivision 2 covers food sampling and demonstration, and it excludes, it provides that food handlers' licensing laws do not apply to food product sampling and demonstration at farmer's markets or community events. Subdivision 3 requires that those samples be provided at no cost. Subdivision 4 requires that if you're operating in this manner, the regulatory oversight that the product sampling and demonstration must provide to the regulatory authority upon request, the sources of the food, the type and volume of the food, the equipment used, the time period and location, the availability of facilities for hand washing, information on facilities for ware washing, the available source of water, and methods for waste disposal. Sub 5 is food safety and equipment standards and provides that a person conducting food product sampling and food product demonstrations at these farmers markets or community events must meet health standards that are required for special event food stands under other Department of Health rules. Sub 6 clarifies really that farmers market definition does not preclude farmers market associations from establishing their own definitions of farmers market that are more restrictive than that which are in this proposed in this statute. And then Section 2 really allows the regulatory authority having jurisdiction over food establishments to allow temporary food stands to be in one place longer than 21 days. Such has been the case in Minneapolis and St. Paul for quite some time. With that brief run-through of the bill, I have Cecilia Coulter with the Minnesota Farmers Market Association here to provide some testimony.
Ms. Coulter, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Senators and members of this committee, for the opportunity to testify today regarding the Minnesota Farmers Market Amendment 2060. It is an honor to be here and an honor to represent Minnesota Farmers Markets. My name is Cecilia Coulter. I'm a board director of the Minnesota Farmers Market Association, founder and market manager for the Chisago City Farmers Market in Chisago County, and a longtime vendor at various Minnesota farmers markets. Community members and I joined forces 2 years ago to establish the Chisago City Farmers Market. We wanted to bring fresh local food to our community, but also help teach our customers on how best to use the wide variety of products that were found at our market. We soon faced significant hurdles as we planned two of the most popular activities at today's farmers markets, cooking demonstrations and sampling. Today's model of a farmers market didn't seem to fit under current regulatory categories. So over the last year and a half, the MFMA has worked with representatives of the Minnesota Department of Agriculture, Minnesota Department of Health, local health departments, and the Minnesota Farmers Union to figure out how these activities can be safely and efficiently accomplished at our farmers markets. And the result is the amendment before you today. The MFMA is, again, indebted to the agencies just mentioned for their guidance these past months in crafting this amendment. This bill is significantly important as it will enable all Minnesota farmers markets, including those in outside Minnesota, to offer food sampling and cooking demonstrations during the whole market season while closely following the existing food code to ensure safe food for the public. This amendment will benefit all Minnesota farmers markets by promoting activities such as sampling and food demonstrations that have the power of transforming our farmers markets into vibrant community events and thereby transforming our own communities, offering viable economic outlets for small local farmers and small business owners, and creating community hubs for residents and tourists, all while promoting and supporting local economies. Thank you for your time and support.
Thank you very much, Ms. Coulter. Any questions for the witness or for Senator Lori? Thanks, Senator Lori, for all your hard work on this. I know you've done a lot in this regard, and it's good work. Would anyone else like to testify on Senate File 2060? No? Okay. Any further discussion, members? If not, Senator Eakin moves that Senate File 2060 as amended be recommended to pass. Any further discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed, nay. The motion prevails. The bill is passed. Thank you very much, Senator Lori.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Senator Schmidt had to step out, so we're going to move to Senator Bonhoff's bill next if she's ready to go. Senate File 2633. Senator Bonhoff, Senate File 2633 is before the committee.
It's your baby, now back to you.
When is it going to be done for the first time? It has to be done every first time.
Senator Bonhoff.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. I'm joined here by Commissioner Bowerly, Deputy Commissioner Bowerly of Workforce Development, and Brian Lindsley, the Executive Director of MSP WIN. So, members, I do have the A1, if you'd like to just have that before you first.
Okay, Senator Bonhoff has the A1 amendment to put the bill in the shape the author would like. It should be coming around to folks. On Senator Bonhoff's motion, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? No. The motion prevails. The A1 amendment is adopted. Senator Bonhoff.
Thank you very much. This bill is a bill that I think once you hear about it, if you haven't had a chance to look at it, you will share my excitement. Because we all know that we put a tremendous amount of our resources towards workforce development funds, and we do that because it is so very important. We know there's nothing more important than having each and every person working. And so what this bill does is it provides for a more uniform system of evaluating whether or not the funds we're spending are, in fact, bringing us the kind of return we're looking for. We have a strong tradition of supporting workforce development, and we do value this. However, the breadth of our programs also raise an accountability issue. We must ensure that our programs are not just being conducted in good faith, but actually produce the results for those we are aiming to help. Senate File 2633 builds on current law, which requires DEED to measure and report on outcomes of our adult workforce programs. It requires a report card to be produced every 2 years by each program. It also asks for a net impact analysis, and I think of that as a return on investment analysis, to be conducted by an independent contractor every 4 years, and that would begin, in fact, this next December. While the data is currently being collected, this bill seeks to standardize the reports and definitions so that the reports are uniform and easier to understand. The regular reporting will help us clearly understand which programs are working and for whom. The amendment deleted Section 1 so that it narrowed the scope of the bill for this year to make it more manageable and cost-effective. Section 1 of the bill, then, is deleted by that amendment. Section 2 lays out the standardized report card and the net impact analysis. The first subdivision requires DEED to develop and implement a uniform outcome measurement and reporting system for adult workforce programs. Subdivision 2 defines some of the workforce terms used in the rest of the bill. Subdivision 3 outlines the timeline for the uniform report. DEED will report the information to the legislature once every biennium in December of even-numbered years. This subdivision also specifies the metrics to be collected and reported in the uniform report. These include whether a program participant received a credential through the program, the median wage data, pre-enrollment and post-enrollment, and important demographic information. I know members have come to me wanting to make sure that as we distribute our workforce funds, that we're looking at the subgroups where we have the worst employment rates. And so by collecting the data in this way, we'll be able to see, are those dollars, in fact, changing that trajectory? Subdivision 4 and 5 require the grantees to share the required data with DEED and lay out the timing for that reporting. We require programs that currently receive these funds to provide the information to DEED in order to be eligible to reapply for state funds in the future. New program applicants must have a plan in place to report the information and share that plan with the commissioner. The net impact analysis requires DEED to contract with an independent entity to conduct a net impact analysis of adult workforce programs funded by the Workforce Development Fund. This analysis would be done every 4 years and would be built on the work currently being done by the Governor's Workforce Development Council. It would include a cost-benefit analysis of these investments. The report would be shared with the legislature and made available to the public. Section 3 appropriates money in 2015 to DEED to implement the requirements of this bill. Members, some of you also serve on the Higher Ed Committee, where we asked Commissioner Bowerly and Commissioner Clark Sieben to come to us and talk about the Workforce Development Funds and what we spend them on. And so I think in that committee we were all left with the idea that we really did want more clear and concise data about outcomes. And so I'm, again, as I said, pleased to be here with this bill. And I welcome the testimony of both Mr. Lindsley and Commissioner Bowerly.
Sure. Thank you, Senator Bonoff and Deputy Commissioner. Whichever one of you would like to go first, go ahead.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Cynthia Bowerly. I'm the Deputy Commissioner for Workforce Development at the Department of Employment and Economic Development. DEED shares the commitment to measuring program performance and understanding the results for our workforce programs. As you know, our workforce programs serve Minnesotans across the state, from veterans to persons with disabilities, youth, laid-off workers, and others just trying to get into the job market. These programs each aim to ensure that Minnesotans have access to good jobs with family-sustaining wages. As required by existing state and federal law, each of these programs is required to report on outcomes, some in different formats. So we have required federal reports that we produce regularly, as well as annual reports for the State Dislocated Worker Program and other workforce development fund programs. Each of these requires us to include placement, training, retention, and wages across the number of these programs. We collect a great deal of this data about participants and programs, including the vast majority of elements identified in this bill. And we agree that this is an important opportunity to present this information in a way that is more accessible to decision makers and public alike. So while we will continue to report as we're required to as pursuant to federal and existing state law, of course, we're happy to work on this new endeavor to provide additional ways of presenting that information and additional formats for that information as we move forward. We appreciate the opportunity to work on this new approach and provide access to this data and the necessary resources. We appreciate the interest and commitment in workforce programs, which are so important to the economic competitiveness of Minnesota.
Thank you very much, Deputy Commissioner. Any questions for the Deputy Commissioner? If not, welcome to the committee.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, and thank you for the opportunity to speak with you this afternoon. My name is Brian Lindsley, and I'm the Executive Director of the Minneapolis-St. Paul Regional Workforce Innovation Network, or MSPWIN. We are a philanthropic collaborative representing 11 regional, statewide, and national funders. MSPWIN seeks a prosperous and equitable Minnesota where businesses have the skilled workers they need to compete, and all adults have the opportunity to participate in the workforce and advance toward family-sustaining wages. I'm here today to speak strongly in favor of Senate File 2633, which implements standardized outcome reporting and net impact evaluation. I think we all want to make the workforce system better for participants and for businesses that need skilled workers. One big step in that direction is standardized outcome reporting, which will get us all on the same page. This approach will reduce confusion through standard definitions. It will also highlight who is being served and help identify the gaps in our adult workforce development system. We know that the workforce programs are not one size fits all, and it is exactly for this reason that we think standard reporting is important. A standardized report will provide a solid baseline for understanding workforce program outcomes. Minnesota's workforce training providers currently collect a wide range of important data about participants and program outcomes. This bill simply asks that the data be reported in a standard way. Most important, it will infuse the workforce development system with transparency. With standard, short reports with common definitions, we believe that you will be more informed about the programs you fund. The next step in this process is net impact evaluation. Net impact analysis uses statistical techniques to determine how workforce program participants do relative to similar people who did not participate in the program. In other words, it determines whether outcomes are a result of the program itself or would have occurred anyway, even without participating in the program. The Governor's Workforce Development Council has been conducting a limited net impact pilot evaluation of three programs for Dislocated Worker, WIA Adult, and Twin Cities Rise, but progress has been slowed due in large part to the reliance on a volunteer economist. We strongly believe this effort needs to be prioritized and invested in, and this bill does just that. It requires the results of the pilot program be shared with legislators and expands that evaluation to adult training programs in the Workforce Development Fund. Without this kind of analysis, Minnesota will be behind peer states in evaluating and improving its workforce programs. We believe it is worth a reasonable investment to help determine the impact these programs have on our workforce challenges. Net impact will show how workforce outcomes, like getting a job, result in additional tax revenue, reduced benefit spending, and incarceration avoidance. Programs with significant impact will likely pay for themselves, yet without net impact analysis, we don't know which programs can provide high value to participants and the state. We believe the passage of a standardized outcome report card and net impact analysis will result in efficiency, effectiveness, and equity in the adult workforce system. We believe they will help reduce duplicative and time-consuming reports and provide legislators with a clearer sense of how our investments are addressing today's workforce challenges and opportunities. It will also tell us how we are meeting the skill needs of employers, addressing employment disparities, and closing skill gaps. These reporting tools are by no means intended to serve as the only measurement for workforce program success. Rather, they are critical tools to ensure that you have objective, reliable information to assist you in making informed funding decisions. We look forward to continuing to work with Senator Bonhoff and Deed to move this effort forward. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Lindsley. Any questions of Senator Bonhoeff or her witnesses? Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Senator Nelson, I'm sorry.
Thank you. Senator Bonhoeff, I'm just noticing on line 1.18 where the language is being struck in lines 18 through 21. And I do see that there's still, in the subsequent lines, a report to the legislature. But I notice on line 1.18, it says the report and the formula shall be submitted to the chairs and ranking minority members. And so I want to know about the formula and this report. And tell me about the different reporting requirements that are under your bill as compared to current law.
Mr. Chair, Senator Nelson, I'm going to defer to Commissioner Bowerly. As you can see, that's an old report because it was due in 2009, mm-hmm. the stricken language. And so what this bill does is it delineates a very clear and standard type of reporting. I'm not familiar with what was done in 2009, but we can...
Yeah. And Mr.
Senator
Chair,
Nelson.
Just before, thank you so much. And so what I'm really missing is the formula. And so what formula are we talking about? And it appears that it's not going to be reported now. And so maybe I could just get some background information on that.
Okay. Deputy Commissioner.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Nelson, I believe this language was referring to the formula that is being used by the GWDC net impact analysis and that methodology that has been developed in those pilots. So as we have worked through some amendments with this, there is still a requirement that DEED report on that GWDC work to the legislature. I believe that is the reference to the formula.
Mr. Chair, GWDC, so, Governor's Workforce Development Council.
Yes, Senator Nelson.
I'm on the council.
Yeah, so okay, so you knew that.
I'm just a little surprised.
But
by
Senator
this.
Nelson, want to make sure everybody knew that.
Yes, thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Well, Mr. Chair,
go ahead, Senator Nelson. I'm sorry.
So, did the GWDC take a position on this bill, or did they help you in bringing this piece of legislation forward?
Deputy Commissioner, Senator Bonnet.
Yeah. Mr. Chair, it looks like there's somebody who might have
okay.
comments in there.
Go ahead. I'll take care of it. Thank
okay.
you. Thank you. The GWDC had a meeting in February where it considered, it has started drafting recommendations about the ROI work that has been ongoing for approximately 4 years. And the members of the council, including yourself, will be receiving a draft of that report in the next few weeks for it to vote on in terms of recommendations. This language has not been presented to the GWDC for its consideration. It is still looking at recommendations regarding the past work on the ROI and the pilots, which are not quite complete but should be complete by May 1st. So as members of the GWC, we'll be receiving updates on that work as we move forward.
Senator Nelson, I'm sorry.
It just seems that it would have been very helpful to have worked with members from the GWDC on this legislation. And usually our best legislation does come when we have all the stakeholders involved. And so I'm just a little bit surprised that this is coming without the support or even the knowledge or the background of the members of the Governor's Workforce Development Council.
Mr. Lindsley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Nelson. So I formerly was the Executive Director of the Governor's Workforce Development Council and have been in touch with staff and some of the council members about this. I think the intent of this legislation is to provide support for the pilot work that the GWDC has been doing and wanted to make sure that the results of that pilot work were shared with legislators.
Deputy
Mr.
Commissioner,
Chair,
I'm sorry, or Senator Bonhoeff.
I just wanted to make sure that that Senator Nelson does understand that a key part of this is reporting back to the legislature so that we do have a clear way of evaluating whether or not we're getting the best outcomes for our dollars that our businesses are really providing.
Thank you,
Senator Nelson.
And actually, I appreciate that look. I think what I was concerned about was one report included a formula that was being used, and now it appears that we're not
right.
Seeing that formula.
Got it.
So, thank you.
Senator
Eakin.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I have an amendment that I would like to offer, the A2 amendment.
Okay. Thomas.
So I would like to move that amendment.
Okay. Let's let members give it. Maybe you can explain the amendment a little bit sooner. Sure.
And this amendment is asks for a study of North Dakota oil production and its impact on Minnesota. And we have been in discussion with DEED and also with Department of Finance. This study would be conducted by DEED in consultation with the Revenue Department. It would ask for $150,000 in fiscal year 2014 be appropriated for this purpose. The reason that this is being asked for is because of the huge oil boom that's taking place in North Dakota right now. And North Dakota is now the second largest oil producer in the United States, right after Texas. North Dakota oil production is nearing about 1 million barrels of oil per day. This has resulted in huge budget surpluses in the state of North Dakota, and it poses some unique challenges for us on the Minnesota side. For instance, there was even discussion about doing away with property taxes in North Dakota. So those are some of the challenges that we're up against. It hasn't happened, but property taxes are going down, and there's other challenges as well as a result. North Dakota's personal income has increased to about $51,893 in 2013, which is more than doubled, $25,592 since 2000. So tremendous impact there. Unemployment rate is 2.6% in North Dakota. It's the lowest in the nation, and it's anticipated to continue to decrease. Unemployment in western North Dakota is 1.2%, where the oil fields are. Population growth has exploded in North Dakota as well. North Dakota's population has increased 7.6% since 2010. Minnesota's, ours, grew by 2.2% in that same time period. So it poses unique challenges, as I said, and I represent Morehead, which is right across the border from Fargo, and so we feel at first, I guess we're on the front lines when it comes to some of the challenges that this poses. But that challenge also can open up some opportunities. And the real purpose of this study is to find out how we can turn this challenge really into an opportunity. And I think this study could be the road to harnessing some of the prosperity that's being generated in the oil fields of North Dakota for Minnesota. And so with that, I would ask for support for this amendment. The study is to be objective and evidence-based, empirical data. Is what they're looking to gather through this. The analysis and the study is actually to be conducted by an independent entity that would have demonstrated knowledge in the areas that are under consideration here. I guess we're looking at an entity like IHS Global Insight, which is already doing studies. Obviously, they're the ones that are making the projections for Minnesota's economy. They already know Minnesota's economy well. So that's kind of what we're looking at. And I guess they've changed their name. They're no longer Global Insight, but I guess IHS Economics and Country Risk is what they're called now. But either they or an entity like them in order to actually conduct this study. But again, it would be provided through DEED, again, with the consultation of the Commissioner of Revenue. And so with that, I'll stand for any questions.
Thank you, Senator Eakin, for that explanation. Senator Bonoff, if you'd like to comment.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Eakin had brought this to me, and we don't have a current fiscal note for this bill because we request a fiscal note, but what the amendment did is it took a lot of the cost out of the bill. So I don't yet know what this bill is actually going to cost, and I don't know in terms of how that fits within the overall scope of the target. And so Senator Eakin and I were talking that while I do consider this a friendly amendment, I think it's very important for all of Minnesota to be able to find a way for us to capitalize on the growth in North Dakota. And if there is a way, we should understand what that might look like. This isn't the fiscal committee, so I might be more comfortable with Senator Eaton's approval to just have kind of blank, blank, blank instead of the $150,000 so that our committee's not sending a message to the finance committee saying that this would be the first money that's allocated given there isn't any other mention of finances in the bill.
Sure.
Certainly. Senator Eaton, to that point.
Mr. Chair, and Senator Bonhoff, I'd be open to that. Sure. Thank you.
Okay. So then...
It's all blank appropriation.
Okay. So
I guess I would move to make the appropriation blank to remove the...
1.5. Okay. So we can just incorporate that into your motion, that we would delete $150,000 on line 1.5. Is that the only place? Okay. And then this bill will go to finance, so we'll let those guys find out. Okay, so our members clear on that. Senator Eakins, does the department want to comment at all on this? Deputy Commissioner?
We'd be happy to pursue any analysis you'd like us to at the appropriate time.
Okay, perfect. Further discussion on Senator Weber, I'm sorry.
I am fine with the amendment. I intend to support it. I think it's probably important for us to recognize, obviously, this is a substantial occurrence that has happened in North Dakota. However, I think along with it, maybe time to also reflect upon our analysis of the other border problems that we encounter, both with the difference in tax policy in South Dakota and what that does to Minnesota companies, also with the economic development projects that have developed in Iowa, and perhaps it would be beneficial for the state to have a better understanding of what's sending so many of our jobs across many state lines.
Okay.
And that was somewhat rhetorical, but I think it's something that the department should be concentrating on at all times.
Certainly. Okay. Further discussion on Senator Eakins' amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed say nay. The A2 amendment is adopted. Okay. Senator Bonnet, further discussion on Senate file... 2633. Senator Dames.
I do have a question for Deputy Commissioner Bowerly. Can you give us some idea of what kind of FTEs this might take to do this study or do this impact report or the number of dollars? I always get concerned when we leave these economic or when we leave the appropriations blank and pass legislation that require us to do it.
Okay.
And I think we need some idea of what this cost could be, either in full-time employees or dollars or something like that, so we had some idea what we're passing here.
Sure. Deputy Commissioner?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, we have been asked to prepare a note based on this new version, and that is not complete as of yet. I am sorry to tell you we're just not quite there yet. But I can share with you the types of costs that would go into performing this type of work and give you a ballpark estimate. It will not be the official note because that is not completed yet. For example, the type of work that will go into this will require some additional FTEs. As I mentioned earlier, the department and all of the different workforce providers do collect the data that is behind this type of bill. It is in a significant data warehouse, but that at this point we do not have a robust reporting tool to pull that out for us. So that is done by manual queries by trained, skilled analysts. And so we would expect that we would need to increase FTEs in order to be able to accomplish this bill, particularly in this time frame. The ROI work that is anticipated to be done by an independent evaluator will require a contract, an RFI process. Of course, we would go through the regular contracting process with the state and get the best value contract to perform this work. And that has been estimated to be, I believe, in the neighborhood of about $200,000. There is staff work that does go into that. A contractor does need to be managed and held accountable to that contract. And so there will be some staff time involved in that as well. The ROI work also requires data sharing from other agencies, and that information that is about individual participants needs to be protected well. And so we would engage in data sharing agreements and moving that data from, for example, the Department of Health and Human Services system into ours does also require some resources as well. So we will get you the full fiscal notice as soon as we are able to, based on this new scope of the bill.
Mr. Chair, follow up, if I might, to Senator Dames.
Okay.
I actually then, your question and listening to the answer sparked a question for me, Senator Dames, and that is, Deputy Commissioner, currently are the administrative
things that go towards fulfilling the responsibilities of the Workforce Development Fund being paid for out of the Workforce Development Funds rather than the general fund? And if so, do you know the percent that's spent on admin of the Workforce Development Funds?
Deputy Commissioner?
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee and Senator Bonoff, I will need to get back to you on that. I believe the split right now is yeah. for some programming, does come out of Workforce Development and General Fund. We generally, for many of the programs, do allow for about 5% admin to manage all of those contracts, to monitor those contracts, assess fiscal requirements, and ensure that providers are delivering upon the contract that they have with the department. But if you would allow me just a little bit of time to get you those details, I would want to make sure that they are absolutely correct.
And Mr. Chair, I just ask that because I do honestly want to know, and also I think that as policymakers, anything we pass, we should think about, including the ROI analysis, that if we're going to put forward, you know, some state taxpayer dollars towards something, then we owe the public, what are we getting for that money? So I look at it as something that we might consider having come out of those funds personally. But, okay. Senator Dames, were you also talking more particularly about Senator Eakin's amendment or the whole bill?
The whole
Senator
bill.
Dames.
Gotcha.
Senator
Thank you,
Dames.
Mr. Thank
Chair.
You.
Senator Bonoff, the answer to that would be the whole bill, but I understand you probably wouldn't have that because of the second to the amendment. But Senator Bonoff, can you tell me, do you have a fiscal note for the first part of the bill?
Senator Bonoff?
Mr. Chair, Senator Dames, I don't because it was decided in the other body to take off the first section to lower the costs, and so they haven't been able to give me a fiscal note based on apparently that was the more costly part. So we have requested it, and by the time it gets to finance, obviously for sure, you will have a fiscal note.
Thank you.
Yep, thank you, Senator. Thank you, Senator Bonner. Any further discussion or anyone else want to be heard on Senate File 2633? If not, Senator Bonoff moves that Senate File 2633 as amended be recommended to pass and refer to the Committee on Finance. Any further discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed say nay. The motion prevails. The bill is passed. Thank you, Senator Bonoff. Now we'll go back to Senator Schmidt. Senator Schmidt's got a couple bills before the committee today. I think we'll start with Senate File 2204, if that's okay with you, Senator Schmidt, the Farm to Food Shelf Program Establishment. Senator Schmidt, welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chair and committee members, before us today we have Senate File 2204. This is the Farm to Food Shelf Bill. And I should mention that so too are Senate File 2497, chief authored by Senator Coonan, and also Senate File 2835, chief authored by Senator Eakin. So these bills together are the Farm to Food Shelf bills, and the idea of these bills is to bring millions of pounds of fresh Minnesota-grown fruits and vegetables to food shelves across the state. This bill is good for farmers, good for rural economies, and good for the families and seniors in Minnesota who must use food shelves to make ends meet each month. Although our economy is getting better in Minnesota, our current budget surplus is proof of that. For many of our neighbors, recovery is coming very slowly. Some folks who lost their jobs in the 2008 crash are working again, but at a fraction of their former incomes. This is especially true for our older workers. Many families are just one major expense, whether due to injury, illness, or severe weather, away from needing a temporary support of the food shelf to put food on the table. This bill is value-added for farmers because it moves surplus vegetables and fruits from the waste stream into the food stream. This bill has the support of the Farmers Union, the Farmers Bureau, the Agriculture Council, and the Hunger Relief Community of Minnesota. With me today to present more detail on this bill are folks from two of the Feeding America food banks that serve Minnesota, Second Harvest Heartland of St. Paul and Channel 1 of Rochester, as well as a farmer who participates in the program. So thank you, Mr. Chair, for the opportunity to present 2204. If you'd entertain some additional testimony, we're ready.
Sure. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, I'm Greta Gothier from Second Harvest Heartland Food Bank based here in the Twin Cities. We are one of six Feeding America food banks that serves Minnesota. I would just like to add that this bill is the result of a three-year pilot project that Second Harvest Heartland and our sister food banks in Minnesota have been operating, and that pilot was privately funded. And in that pilot was kind of a proof of concept as to whether or not we could move some of these so-called surplus fruits and vegetables from farms to food shelves statewide. And we feel that it's been a great success, and so this bill would continue that process, allow us to expand and bring more farmers into the network. Mr. Chairman, one of the handouts, which I believe I've met with most everybody, but shows that our existing farmer network of farmers who have participated in donating their surplus vegetables and fruits. We have farmers in 36 counties in Minnesota. And then on the flip side, this map will show you where the food will go. And in our pilot, we have distributed the food to every county in the state. And you'll see that it has gone both to food shelves and to other meal programs, such as senior congregate dining or a soup kitchen, that kind of a thing. So we feel that this bill will have statewide benefit, and all of the food banks will work together to ensure that that happens, Mr. Chairman. And with that, I would like to turn it over to Gary Paul, who is one of our participating farmers.
Okay. Ms. Gauthier, is this the first time that you've been back in front of the committee in your new role? Certainly no stranger to this committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Yes, it is.
Oh, good. You did a nice job, as always.
Thank
anyway,
you,
Mr. Paul, I'm sorry. Go ahead. Please proceed with your
testimony. This is my first time. Mr. Chair, thanks for inviting me to speak today on behalf of Second Harvest. My story goes back a couple years ago when our farm, which is located in Apple Valley, Rosemont area, we farm about 1,100 acres of fruits and vegetables and that type of thing. And we came upon a dilemma after having, it was about three weeks of consistently 90-degree weather days and about 75-degree nights. And what happened, it was our sweet corn production bunched up. We're nothing but fresh market. So our product goes from Targets, Walmarts, Cubs, Rainbows. We cover the whole gamut. And our problem was everything that was planted in the spring from, a three-week period all came to fruition and it was ready to harvest within a 1 week's time. Well, being fresh market, not all your stores are capable of selling that type of harvest at that volume during that particular week. So I contacted Tony Manns, and Tony Manns was more than helpful for lining up additional semi-loads. And in that particular week, we shipped 7 semi-loads of product of sweet corn across not only in Minnesota but across the feeding network of the United States. And that would not happen if it wasn't for Second Harvest. And the only thing that we were asking for is to get our labor costs back up from packing. The only thing, what stops us from donating or, excess harvest and that kind of thing is a excessive cost of labor. So what this bill really provides is to give the farmers a small portion of, the labor costs and cover that in turn for a product that would otherwise be dissed up and discarded and left in the field. So that's all I have to say.
Mr. Paul, thank you very much. And, it seems like it makes a lot of sense. Instead of just plowing that food under, why don't we get it out the door and to some people that can use it? So thank you for...
Well, in the 3 years ago, we had about 7 semi-loads. This past year, working with Tony and scheduling some different things, we were up to 24 semi-loads going to different food shelves. That was 840-some thousand pounds just off of our farm alone.
Very good. Thank you. Ms. Woodford, welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Jennifer Woodford, and I'm the executive director of Channel 1 Regional Food Bank, which serves 13 counties in southeast Minnesota. The numbers that we see on a daily basis are staggering. There are nearly 10 million missing meals in our service area alone each year, and it would take over $250 million to close the food gap in our region. Each month, 3,700 families visit the Channel 1 Supplemental Food Shelf in Olmsted County. And by working in partnership with other hunger relief agencies, we will distribute 10 million pounds of food to over 100,000 people struggling with hunger this year. The people that we help feed face staggering numbers of their own. $4 for 3 pounds of apples, $2 for one squash, $3 for a bundle of fresh spinach. With those same numbers, a person on an extremely limited food budget could buy one can of tuna and a box of tuna helper, or a package of processed lunch meat and a loaf of white bread. Every day, we hear from people who deal with their own staggering numbers. And these people struggle, sometimes to the point of tears, as they work on a shopping list for their family. Because due to the staggering numbers in front of them, they know they can't afford the fresh apples, squash, or spinach that they really want to feed their families. Instead, they will buy the canned tuna and other processed foods that they can stretch further with their small food budgets. In 2010, Channel 1 distributed only 1 million pounds of fresh produce. But over the past 3 years, we have been an active part of the agricultural surplus pilot program with our fellow food banks in Minnesota. And thanks to grant funds received and other efforts, in 2013, we were able to significantly increase the amount of fresh produce that we were able to secure and distribute, nearly 2 million pounds of fresh produce. We know that hunger hurts. It hurts families trying to feed themselves on a single income. It hurts the health and well-being of our senior population. It hurts educational opportunities for kids who don't have enough to eat at home. We can and will continue to provide food to those who are hurting. But we also know that what we feed people is extremely important. Funds granted to farmers in the Farm to Food Shelf program would provide an additional 10 million pounds of agricultural surplus to help feed people struggling with hunger all throughout Minnesota. 10 million pounds of fresh potatoes, sweet corn, tomatoes, cantaloupe, apples, and many other crops that will feed people what they need to thrive. I brought with me a voice today from one of our clients. It was on this empty paper plate, and I apologize. I know it's hard to see, but I'll tell you what it says. It was written by a little girl named Jenna, who was a client in our food shelf. And it says, "Hunger feels like you are starving for food, and we need people to help." And then she drew a drawing of herself, and it's hard to see, but on her face, there's a tear. On behalf of Jenna and the thousands of people in southeast Minnesota that we help feed each day and who need your help, we thank you for your consideration of this important legislation.
Thank you, Mrs. Woodford, for your testimony. Any questions for Senator Schmidt or the two witnesses? Would anyone else like to be heard on Senate File 2204? Oh, I'm sorry, Senator Nelson.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. I just have a question on the bill itself.
Sure.
Certainly, I appreciate this effort, and I think it's a good effort to take food that's not being used and get it into our food shelves. So I appreciate that. My question, Senator Schmidt, has to do with line 1.15, where Second Harvest may use up to 11% of the grant for administrative expenses. And I'm wondering if you could speak to that a little bit. Usually, we limit 5% for administrative expenses, and so this is nearly double that. And so I'm just wondering, you know, why are we putting so much in administrative expenses as opposed to food?
Mr. Chair and Senator Nelson, I appreciate the question, and I figured that's where the first question may go. So I'll allow Ms. Gauthier to address that question, if you don't mind.
Okay. Ms. Gauthier.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members, and Senator Nelson. Yes, the number is up to 11%. And where that came from was a 2010 report by the Minnesota Council on Nonprofits. And that report outlined for various size nonprofits in terms of their total asset, what their typical administrative cost for providing a program should be. So in that report, which I would be happy to email to the committee, but you can find it online, it stated for nonprofits that were of the size that Second Harvest Heartland is, that 11% is the standard overhead administration fee or amount that is that should be expected and is normally seen in that size of an organization. And I'd be happy to, again, email you that report.
Sarah Nelson, was that helpful?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It was helpful, but it doesn't really get to the gist of my question, which is, why is this amount needed? While the report might show that nonprofits usually have an 11% administrative expense, typically here at the state, we've like with the LIHEAP program that we passed, I think we limited those administrative expenses to 5%. And so I'll be glad to look at that report, but I just want to just note that these are higher administrative expenses than we typically look at in the state of Minnesota. And most of the nonprofits organizing entities that look at, you know, how do you determine nonprofits, usually they say under 10%. You want to make sure those administrative expenses are under 10%. So I'm concerned about the high cost of the administrative expenses.
Scott Thier.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Senator Nelson. Thank you for that comment. Actually, as an organization, 96% of what our donations are goes towards the service that we provide. But the report was talking about when a new program is being started or a new service. What we would mainly be focusing on with that 11%, Mr. Chairman, is outreach to additional farmers. We would like to greatly expand this network of farmers that we have. We started by working with our partners at Cub Foods and Target Super Value, some of the larger retailers in town, because they are the ones that usually donate to us. And we asked them, where do you get your vegetables and so forth? So we ended up talking to Mr. Paul and others who are some of the larger growers in Minnesota. But we would really like to reach out to quite a bit, a vaster number of farmers. And in order to do that, we would like to be able to dedicate some staff time to really building that network. Since that was a pilot program, we do not have a staff person that would be doing that. We would need to continue an existing person we have and add a person just to handle the outreach to the farmers and to get them lined up and ready so that they understand the procedures should they have surplus food that they would like to donate to food shelves. So we have outreach supplies and outreach efforts in our budget. We also will be traveling to every single farm. We need to be able to be sure we can verify the donations that are being made and that the farmers are in compliance with everything that the Department of Agriculture would require us to comply. So perhaps it might go down in future years, but we would really like to pour some funds and some effort into building a very, very broad and strong farmer network. We'd like to reach out to some of the medium-sized farmers particularly and some of the others that we have not yet been able to get in touch with.
Sarah Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Ms. Gauthier. That certainly did help explain that cost, and I appreciate that. And especially in a new program, the importance of expanding the network, I definitely understand that. So thank you for that clarification.
Thank you. Any further discussion? If not, Senator Schmidt moves that Senate file 2204 be recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on Finance. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed say nay. The motion prevails. The bill is passed. Thank you, Senator Schmidt.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Schmidt.
Mr. Chair,
Senate file 2529.
Yes, we have Senate file 2529 in front of us here today. And I should just, by way of background, and I'll try to cut to the chase here, for the last several years, the federal government has been funding a pretty intensive mapping project underway, and Connect Minnesota is Minnesota's version of it. They've been before this committee at least a couple of times in the last few years. And the idea behind the mapping is to get a sense on what parts of Minnesota are served, what parts of Minnesota are underserved, and what part of Minnesota is doing pretty well in terms of broadband access and infrastructure and the services that are delivered over that. And the one trick with this, though, is the federal funding runs out at the end of the year. And what this bill intends to do is provide an appropriation for the year moving forward in 2015 to continue those mapping efforts. I know here in Minnesota we've had a lot of attention directed towards broadband. I think trying to get a good handle on what the facts are and being able to chart Minnesota's progress moving forward is very important in that conversation. I think folks would probably all agree that the mapping is not perfect and it has its shortcomings, but it's the best thing we got. And I think the folks who are behind this effort are doing a pretty darn good job, and it certainly informs the debate that we're having here at the legislature and throughout Minnesota. And so what I would encourage this legislature to do, and starting with this committee, is to consider seriously the appropriation before you here and to continue those meaningful mapping efforts in the year ahead. So with that said, we have no shortage of, I think, testimony in the audience here today. If folks would like to hear from providers who are doing this good work and collaborating in this mapping effort, but we don't necessarily need to. I know Connect Minnesota and supporters have been before this committee in the recent past.
Senator Schmidt, thank you. Would anyone else like to be heard on Senate File 2529? This is an important mapping project, and I think that most of the members support it, but obviously if anyone would like to come forward at this time, they certainly can.
And Mr. Chair, if I could, if
Senator
there are no
Schmidt?
Questions at this point, I do have an A1 amendment that builds off of this effort.
Okay.
And, Mr. Chair, if you don't mind, it's a pretty simple amendment.
Just like the
federal funding for this mapping effort is going away, there's no promise that future funding for deploying broadband infrastructure and service into greater Minnesota will continue. There's been a lot of changes at the federal level in terms of what qualifies and where the funding is coming from and where it's going. And what we'd like to do with this A1 amendment is appropriate an additional $250,000 to study this issue and to get a firm handle on where the federal government is going in terms of promoting rural broadband access, and particularly as it would apply to Minnesota. We have a lot of great effort and discussion on improving access to broadband in greater Minnesota, but we have to know what our federal partners are going to be doing for us in the years ahead. There's some clear signals that their support may not continue as it has in the past, and what this amendment does is it funds a study that would help us get a better understanding of what we might expect out of the federal government in the years ahead.
Senator Nelson, did you have a question?
I do have a question.
Okay.
It's not exactly – well, I do have a comment on this amendment, but my other question was on the bill itself. But on the amendment, I can't really understand why we would spend $250,000 to try and anticipate what the feds are going to do, because it all depends on who's elected and who sits there. So I can't really – this is rather fuzzy to me about – what it is that we anticipate trying to study about what the feds are going to do, because, quite frankly, they don't know what they're going to do because they don't know who's going to be in those seats. So I just am not real sure where you're trying to go with this.
Well, Mr. Chair and Sarah Nelson, you know, I'm trying to be as clear as I can here. What I think Minnesota needs to do is position itself to maximize capital flowing into our broadband investments, whether it's coming from the state, the private sector, or from the federal government. And what this does is tries to inform that discussion. We have a great Office of Broadband Development that I think is doing very good work, but we need to be able to provide good information to the decision makers, both in agency and also to decision makers here at the legislature. And what, Senator Nelson, I can assure you that what we're trying to do is just get a handle on the broader trends, where the range of participation from the federal government might be going, and how Minnesota can position itself to maximize that opportunity, and also falling short of great opportunities coming from the federal government, position ourselves to fill the gap, if that's the case.
Mr. Chair.
Sarah Nelson.
So, do you want to adopt this first? Then I have a question to the bill itself.
I guess I think that, in fairness to the author, it is an author's amendment. Obviously, we want to have the discussion, but I guess you can decide how you want to vote on the bill after that. But maybe we should take action on the amendment,
sure,
if that's okay. Senator Schmidt would move the A1 amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed say nay. The motion prevails, and the A1 amendment is adopted. Okay, Senator Nelson to the bill, or Senator Weber, I think, had his hand up too, if you want to wait a second.
I'll defer to Senator Nelson.
Senator Nelson.
Thank you. Well, Mr. Schmidt, Senator Schmidt, you know, we've had a lot of discussions about mapping, and I think everyone in this room probably realizes how important broadband is to our growing economy, education, telemedicine, all of those things. And so I think we're all converts there. We know how important that is. But, you know, I do have some questions on additional money for mapping for a couple reasons. One, we've seen the maps that have come out so far, and they're not accurate. They don't measure accurately what's happening in our state. So, for example, let me mention the Olmsted County example again. In January of 2013, we were told that 20% of Olmsted County households met the statewide broadband goal, and we knew that was wrong. But now this year, I'm not sure what happened, but now it says 30% of the households meet the statewide broadband goal, and yet I've got the data here. That's not accurate. There's 56,000 households in Olmsted County. 52,037 of them are in Byron, Eota, and Stuartville. So all in all of Olmsted County, 92% of the homes are served by Charter Communications, which does meet the broadband goal, and that doesn't even include the other providers like Bevcom, Frontier Communications, CenturyLink, Hiawatha Broadband, and AT&T Wireless. And so when we're talking about more money to study mapping, I get very concerned because the money that we've spent so far to map doesn't seem like it's really done the job. It seems like it's been inaccurate. So my questions are this. One, how much has been spent in federal funding already on mapping? How do we know that if there's more money spent on mapping, what are we going to find out that we don't already know? Who is going to do this between the independent organizations? What's an independent organization? I need some clarification on that definition. But kind of tell me why this is a good idea to spend $450,000 for more mapping, and why isn't that part of what's been done already?
Senator Schmidt.
Mr. Chair and Senator Nelson, I appreciate the questions. I know you've asked that question regarding Olmsted County in this committee, I think, in each of the last 2 years. And perhaps we could have folks from Connect Minnesota come up here to address that one in particular. I have to tell you, I think it's clear that the maps are not perfect. There are areas, you know, I've been around the state, I've talked to folks, and every city I visit, they say, Matt, the map doesn't tell the story. But it does provide us information that's useful for the discussion. It helps us get a better understanding of the improvements that are being made in the general picture out in greater Minnesota. And I think it's vital to the conversations that we're going to have here in the legislature, both this year and in the years ahead, about broadband investments. And also it's important for our communities and our private providers to be able to work together and try to agree to the extent we can on the facts. And that's what the mapping effort is trying to do. Now, I should just mention here, before we invite anyone else up here to testify if they'd like, is that there's continuing conversation between the providers and also state agency over some specifics of this bill. There's an amendment that is being discussed outside of committee right now that I would anticipate would shed some further detail on a couple of the questions you raise. We just don't have agreement on it quite yet. So I understand your concerns over, you know, who's going to be doing this and where is it going to be coming from. But I can tell you that this has been a very constructive conversation, both between agencies and also involving the provider community. And it's something that a lot of folks would agree to is valuable. And although it's not perfect, I would just say, warn us, let's not let the perfect become the enemy of the good here. These maps do provide a lot of good, helpful information for us. And in this discussion, I think almost any time we're talking about access in greater Minnesota, somebody is referring to the maps and in the story that they try to tell.
Thank you. Senator Weber?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. 2 points, I guess, I have. Number one, Senator Schmidt, I guess maybe it was alluded to there. The concern I have is that, okay, we're going to pick off where the feds are leaving, and, you know, do our rules allow us to sort of just continue on the way we are, or are we going to wind up with a new contract to someone that actually we wind up spending money to do things we've already done? You know, in that regard. And I guess the second thing that I'll mention is I do have a problem with the amendment. In my opinion, quite frankly, it endangers the bill for my vote. because quite frankly, I think trying to anticipate what the feds are doing is sort of like trying to handle silly putty, because quite frankly, it keeps shifting on you as you work through it. So, I think, in all honesty, it's $250,000. Like, to quote my late father, we just threw down a rat hole. So, anyway.
Okay. Senator Schmidt, would you like to respond? Or?
Mr. Chair, if I could just reiterate that the federal role in providing funding for deployment of broadband in rural areas is changing. And, of course, we can't predict what the next Congress is going to be and what they're going to do, but there are some big trend lines here. And some very key indications coming out of Washington, and I'd be remiss not to say that if Minnesota didn't take an intentional step to understand the future federal role and how to maximize our take on that, if you will, and how to position ourselves to maximize investments in broadband infrastructure, we'd be losing out. And that's what this study is trying to do. We don't have a resource anywhere in state agency that can do this by themselves at current funding. And so what we're trying to do is say this is a specific deliverable that we're asking for that's going to shed incredible light on this discussion, and we want to fund it. And we want to come back here next legislative session and have answers to these questions.
Senator Weber.
One last comment, Mr. Chairman. Senator Schmidt. I find it inconceivable, in light of the amount of money this legislature has spent, that there's not $250,000 lying there to do it. So,
Senator Dames.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Senator Schmidt. The $450,000, how did you arrive at that number?
Senator Schmidt.
I would actually ask agency to come here. This is a number that has been shared with me, and I know it's not nearly as much as was originally devoted to this effort coming from the federal government, but it's enough to keep this process going.
Okay.
And to update our maps.
All right. Well, someone from the Office of Broadband, I think, is coming forward. Welcome to the committee. Did you understand Senator Dames' questions, or would you like him to repeat it?
I believe I do.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, members, my name is Dana McKenzie, and I'm the Executive Director of the Office of Broadband Development. And the number that is being used in this bill, I believe, this is not a deed-sponsored bill, but I believe the number came from a combination of the findings from the Broadband Task Force report, the 2014 Broadband Task Force report, in addition to a estimate that was requested from the current vendor as to given a pared-down version of the work they're currently doing under the federal contract. This was based on an estimate they provided to the state.
Senator Dames.
Thank you, ma'am. And Senator Schmidt, I'd have the same question on the $250,000 appropriation for the study. Where's that number coming from?
Senator Schmidt.
Mr. Chair and Senator Dames, we've looked at similar efforts elsewhere and what a comprehensive review would cost, and we wanted to make sure that we could fund it fully. And if we're going to get a full understanding of the moving parts, how Minnesota can position itself to optimize investment in broadband, whether it's from the federal government or elsewhere, we've got to make sure that we've got the resources in place to take a good hard look at this question. And so that's based upon conversations I've had with folks who've done these in the past and the expectation of what it would take to do this right.
Senator Dames.
Thank you, Senator Schmidt. And I would just like to make the comment that I felt that the original bill was kind of a reach, but I think with the amendment on there, it's just more of a reach that I'm going to be willing to support.
Senator Bonhoff and Senator Nelson.
Mr. Chair and Senator Schmidt, this isn't the fiscal committee, but I think you are hearing the concern about going from the 450 and now the 250. Would it not be possible, and it sounds like based on your last answer, maybe you don't think so, but to incorporate your language from your amendment into what you're requiring? So in other words, that you the bill stipulates that you want the broadband service mapping to be done, and in addition, you would direct the Office of Broadband to look at the changes coming federally and have a strategy and provide the legislature with a strategy to how to deal with that. I think perhaps that could accomplish the intent without raising some of the, kind of the sticker shock from the committee members.
Sure. And Mr. Chair and Senator Bonoff, I mean, we pass bills out of here all the time that don't have specified appropriations. These numbers are not pulled out of the sky. They're there for a reason. But I think in this committee, talking about the policy, I hope that folks could rally around the notion that having maps and agreeing to where services is better and where it's lacking, and agreeing that studying future possibilities for investment and leveraging capital for broadband deployment, they're good things. And I think that we'll have plenty of discussion in the finance division over how much to spend on this. And if it would make members feel better not specifying how much we're asking for in the study, I would accept that. I have to tell you, folks, this is members, in all due respect, these are incredibly important things that we'd be doing in Minnesota, and I can't emphasize that enough. And I think this room is full of folks who've been talking to me for the last several weeks and months about continuing the effort to map. And I have to tell you, this is an important effort.
Senator Bonoff.
Well, Mr. Chair, I guess the one concern would be that the committee expresses the concern around the amount, for example, to study what's happening in the federal and come up with a response. It's rather than just to delete appropriation, I think the message is we'd like that to be done, but we don't think it's that amount. So I would hate to then, to Senator Dames might feel then, I don't know, Mr. Chair, if Senator Dames would answer a question. Are you on the Finance Committee?
No.
Senator Dames.
Yeah. So that's you are. So the challenge would then be we'd leave it go, and then the next committee would say, oh, it is worth this and that.
Sure. Mr. Chair and Senator, I'm open to the wisdom of the committee here on this. I just, darn it, this is important stuff, and I hope that whether we specify what we're asking for or not, that folks understand that.
Senator Weber.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Bonoff, I'm willing to support the bill for the original bill. I have heartburn on the amendment, and I'm one of these that I really hate, and I mean really hate, sending bills out of committee that I think are wrong, and I feel the amendment's wrong, and so obviously I argue against that study and Finance Committee, but with the amendment on, my vote is no today as well, because that's how strongly I feel about it.
Okay, fair enough.
So maybe we need to take the amendment off.
Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I agree with the importance of this. I mean, it is an economic imperative that we have high-speed broadband access throughout our state. I think that's true. We all agree on that. But it is really important also that we make sure that the dollars that we're allocating are actually getting us what we're hoping to get. And I maybe part of the issue is, could you describe a little bit, what does it entail to map? I mean, how much of the state is mapped already? How much still needs to be mapped? Like, I didn't remember seeing in all those maps, I didn't remember seeing any map that showed the areas of the state that had not yet been mapped. So, how much are we talking about? And what is that mapping look? What do you hope to accomplish with this $450,000? What is that mapping? Kind of give us some details on that. And then the second question is, who did bring this forward? So the deed, it's not a deed bill.
Sure.
It's not a Office of the Broadband bill. And so who did bring this bill forward? Maybe that's the easier question, and then kind of give me the details on mapping.
Sure. Mr. Chair and Senator Nelson, I have to tell you, this is a bill that I know industry is very excited about, and I know that they have an amendment that they'd like to see address some of the outstanding questions here that you've raised, who's going to be doing this and how. But that's a conversation that's ongoing. But the mapping, to your second question here, is done. It's based upon provider-submitted data that is shared, and it's aggregated. And I can't speak to this. I'm not an expert in the process here, and I don't do this myself. But it's provider-submitted data that is aggregated, and it's turned into a map. I mean, they share a lot of their data on the service level that they're offering in different parts of the state, in different markets, to try to paint a fairly accurate picture of where broadband is available and where it, quite frankly, it's lacking. for one reason or another. And so this is based upon those efforts. This is private provider data that is given to Connect Minnesota in this case. It's not a governmental activity. It's separate from any agency. And the funding's running out. And if we're going to continue this effort and continue to chart what we're getting for those investments, whether they're public or private, in the year ahead, we've got to determine how to pay for this. I know the initial appropriation to get this process started was well over $1 million, and that has continued. And we have a decision to make. Do we want to continue the mapping effort or not?
Senator Dames.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And from listening to the discussion here, I think there's certainly the opportunity to move the bill in its original form forward, but I don't know how far it's going to get with the amendment. So, Mr. Chair, I'm going to move that we reconsider the amendment.
And Mr. Chair, I'd be willing to offer an author's amendment if it makes people feel better about the amended language.
Okay, we'll talk this through, Senator Schmidt. Let's let Senator Dames.
Well, if whatever the correct language would be to, in a sense, revoke that amendment, whatever that correct language is.
Okay, delete section. Senator Schmidt, your thoughts on that, taking off the A1 amendment?
Well, I have to tell you, I, Mr. Chair, I'm not sure if folks are opposed to the effort to study this problem or to the dollar amount. And I have to tell you, I don't know if I've sat in this committee and heard folks have such trouble with a dollar amount before. But if it makes people feel better to strike the appropriation and have it to be determined in Finance Committee, Finance Division, I'm happy to do that. This is important for us to understand what's happening out there, and
we'll
I would
vote for it.
Okay, Senator Rood.
Mr. Chair and Senator Schmidt, for me, it's not the money. I think this amendment kind of looks at it like our commissioners and our industry is acting like an island that doesn't interact with the federal government, and I'm thinking that that's not how government works. I think we interact with our federal government all the time, and I would be very surprised if the commissioners and our industry doesn't already know this, and to spend money on a study that's something that we probably already are doing and know, I think it's really redundant. I can't imagine that we aren't already doing this, and we have federal legislators that maybe should call their office and just ask what they have to offer. It would be a much easier thing than spending money to do a study.
Senator Schmidt?
Mr. Chair, I've said this before, and I understand that we're having a respectful conversation here about this. The last thing I think we should do is throw money at any problem. But in this case, we don't have this information, and this is very integral to what Minnesota does moving forward. And if there are concerns about the dollar amount, so be it. But this is information we don't have, and right now we don't have a way of getting this information. And it's broader than simply, with all the respect, broader than simply talking to our representation in Washington. It's getting a better understanding of the bigger pieces and where they're moving and what we can do to position ourselves.
Okay, Senator Nelson, and I think Senator Dames does have a motion, yes. But go ahead.
Thank you, Nelson. Mr. Chair. So I just want to clarify. I agree with what the governor said. There's a lack of details here. It's the lack of details that is causing me heartburn. I'm still not sure what parts of the state haven't been mapped. I did ask that. How much of the state has not yet been mapped? What are we trying? What's your intention? What are you trying to do with this $450,000 for mapping? So, and what does that entail? I do understand that it entails private providers sending information about their about what they provide and their customers. I understand that, but that's the cost on them to send that to, I'm not sure who it would be sent to, the Office of Broadband, but what are the costs entail? What do you plan to accomplish? What needs to be mapped still? And then what are these costs? Is it the cost of producing the map? Is it the cost of running the data through data analytics? Do we have to develop a new program to harness this data? That's what I'm trying to understand here.
All right.
Senator Schmidt, Mr. Chair,
I've tried to address this question. I think it might be best if I hand it off and maybe have a different perspective, a different crack of the nut.
Maybe at this point, members, we should kind of focus on the A1 amendment because it seems like we're kind of mixing some issues here. Is that fair or not fair?
Agreed. Agree.
Okay. And Senator Schmidt, you'd still like to keep it on, but Senator Dames has made a motion to strike.
Strike section two.
What I would offer is, I think this is an important thing, and I would take out the appropriation. I think that would make people feel better on this committee if we don't specify what we're asking for, and I can drill down more to make sure every dollar asked for is the right amount.
Senator Bonoff and then Senator Dames, I think we're getting close to a vote.
Mr. Chair, I think you're missing something in the conversation, Senator Schmidt. I think if you incorporated your language in such a way that it was clear that the 450 was the max, then you might get a different vote. So rather than the issue isn't deleting the appropriation, because then what that says is you would continue to request an additional dollar amount to study this section, and I think that's what people are thinking, that the 450 is an investment, and Senator Dames may still not vote for it, but I would be willing to look at that within the 450, but not in addition to.
Okay. Right. Senator Dames?
In regards to the amendment, my issue is twofold. It's the amendment, not only the appropriation, and I would be less likely to vote for the bill if we amend it without an appropriation, because now, again, we're just passing legislation with an open checkbook, and I'm just not in favor of that.
Final comment, Senator Schmidt, and then I think we have a motion before us.
Yeah. And I would just, remind folks, this is an author's amendment here, for whatever that's worth, and I'm just trying to get this bill in the shape to discuss it here. We bounce back and forth. If folks would feel better saying that up to, $600,000 can be appropriated for these two efforts. No. That doesn't address your concerns.
Nope.
No.
All right. Well,
I'll call the question.
Okay. We have a motion. I don't think we can call a question in committee, but Senator Dames does have a motion before us. So, members understand Senator Dames is moving to delete Section 2, which was the A1 amendment that we adopted earlier. All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed say nay.
No.
The chair is in doubt. All those in favor of the Dames Amendment, please raise your hand. Those opposed? On a 4-4 vote, the motion does not prevail. Further discussion on Senate File 2529. Seeing none, Senator Schmidt moves that Senate File 2529 as amended be recommended to pass and sent to the Committee on Finance. All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed say nay.
Nay. Nay.
Motion prevails. The bill is passed. Thank you, Senator Schmidt. Next, we have Senator Coonan, and we have three more bills, members, so hopefully we can continue. I know it's kind of a lengthy agenda.
Okay, Senator Coonan, I understand you have an A1 amendment as well to the Senate File 1926?
That's correct, Mr. Chairman.
And
I would like to move the A1 amendment.
Okay, and this would be an author's amendment.
Author's
amendment.
So
first stop. So this is just to get the bill in the shape and form that the author would like. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed? Motion prevails, and the amendment is adopted. Senator Coonan to the bill as amended.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
I'm
happy to say that the A1 amendment is a compromise between the League of Minnesota Cities, the Association of Minnesota Building Officials, and the Department of Labor and Industry. The City of Olivia contacted my office and asked me to support a bill that the League and AMBO were working on because it was important to Olivia and other cities for that matter. This bill changes the way the department delegates authority to local building officials to inspect hospitals, nursing homes, and public buildings. I heard from Olivia and other communities that they were concerned that their certified building officials were having difficulty getting approval from the department to inspect these types of buildings. They thought the current process could be made more clear, and they wanted to have more information about what standards they needed to meet in order to have authority to inspect these buildings. Of course, these are some of the most important buildings in their cities. The League of Minnesota Cities, the Department of Labor and Industry, of course, the state building officials and local building officials work together to come up with the language that you see in the amendment. The bill does a few things. It gives local building officials a better idea what they need to do in order to have the authority to inspect these buildings. It gives building officials a chance to correct any shortcomings that the department identifies when reviewing the local departments. It provides a clear appeals process if that becomes necessary, and it excludes smaller projects from the delegation process. I have with me today Patrick Hines and Lenny Rutledge. Thank you. And I believe, Lenny, you wanted to start off. Is that or
certainly.
Mr. Chairman, thank you.
Mr. Rutledge, if you could state your name for the record, please.
Hi, my name is Lenny Rutledge. I'm the building official with the City of Hutchinson. And I'm honored to be here today to speak in front of all you. I'm here representing the Southwest Minnesota Chapter of Building Officials as well as the Association of Minnesota Building Officials. We have joined together as organizations to try to make sure that we're doing our job in a consistent manner. So we bounce things back and forth. Codes are like laws. There's a lot of interpretation involved in those. And we meet as groups and try to make sure we're all doing the same thing, reading the same thing, understanding the same thing when a code comes across our desk. We're here today in hopes of clarifying a misunderstanding in a law that creates confusion as far as the what the meaning of the word certified in the term certified building official actually means. Quite often, we think of a state-owned or state-licensed facility, such as a school or a church, a school or a hospital or a college. That is true, but so are MnDOT salt sheds, cold storage pole barn-type structures, truck garages, and outstate satellite offices that the state of Minnesota uses throughout the state. Currently, a state-certified building official is qualified to perform plan reviews and inspections on structures such as churches and office buildings and warehouses and retail stores and things like that, as well as a home where people live, raise families, and create memories. So there's quite a gamut of what we are able to inspect without state delegation. But without state delegation, that same building official may not have state approval to inspect a small remodel project at the local hospital or the accessibility update at the local high school. And this bill would take care of that. Actually, without state delegation, a certified building official, a state certified building official, couldn't inspect a fence around a gravel pile or a lean-to onto an existing shed to store snowplow parts in the summer or lawnmowers in the winter. These types of state-owned facilities are conveniently located throughout the state, many of them in jurisdictions where that have adopted the Minnesota State Building Code. A state-certified building official cannot issue these permits because they don't have, they may not have delegation agreement with the state. We, as building official organizations, feel that Senate File 1926 corrects this inconsistency, allowing that state-certified building official, who we trust with our homes, to, if the state municipality, or if the local municipality chooses to, and the state commissioner determines that the local building official is properly trained and staffed to issue these permits and perform these inspections for these types of facilities, as well as the ones mentioned in Senate File 1926 under Section 2, leaving the revenues generated from these permits in those communities where they belong. And I'm going to reiterate what Senator Coonan said. Much of the text for this bill was generated in cooperative effort by all of the users, the Department of Labor and Industry, the League of Minnesota Cities, as well as the local building official groups. That is all. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Rutledge. Any questions at all for Mr. Rutledge? Thanks again. And next, Mr. Hines, if you could state your name for the record, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. For the record, Patrick Hines with the League of Minnesota Cities. I first want to thank Senator Coonan and Senator Weber, both on the committee, for their help with this bill. They are the bill's co-authors. And I'd also like to thank the Department of Labor and Industry. When this issue first came to our attention in the summer and fall, it did seem to have the potential to be a bit of a contentious dispute with the department, but I'm glad to say that all of our conversations starting this fall and up until now have been very cooperative and very constructive. And we have, as we've said, a compromise amendment in front of the committee that I think will make the building inspection process better for both local building officials and state building officials. And I can walk through what the language does, but if the committee wants me to. Otherwise, I can just stand for questions.
Okay, well, we'll see if there's any questions. Any questions for Mr. Hines? Okay, I see none, so you explained it well. Thank you to both of you. And Senator Coonan, would you have any last comments on the bill?
Mr. Chairman and committee, I think with this agreement, you'll see cooperation and working together between the state inspectors and the local inspectors. So I think it's a good piece of work that was put together by all those concerned.
Okay, great. Thank you. And any other testimony? Okay, seeing none, Senator Coonan moves that Senate File 1926, as amended, be recommended to pass. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
All opposed? Motion prevails. Bill is passed. Next, Senator Sparks, Senate File 2440.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. Senate File 2440 represents the Department of Commerce's work to clean up the telecommunication statutes. I do have an author's amendment, the A1 amendment, which I'd like to offer now. And I believe with the adoption of this amendment, we have agreement from all the stakeholders to the content of this bill.
Okay. Senator Sparks moves the A1 amendment, an author's amendment, first stop. So this is just to get the bill in the shape and form that the author would like. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 All opposed? Motion prevails, and the amendment is adopted. Senator Sparks, to the bill as amended.
With that, Mr. Chair, I'd like to thank Commissioner Rothman for his patience. I know he has to be somewhere, so I'd just like to turn over to him at this time, and he can bring this bill together.
Great. Welcome, Commissioner Rothman, if you could state your name for the record, please.
Mr. Chair, Mike Rothman, Commissioner of Commerce. I want to thank Senator Sparks for carrying the bill. Thank the members for their time today and considering it. And just give you a few quick minutes on where we are and the status of all this. The department took a very thorough look at all of the on-session issues. We did a thorough process in two stages. I have to say that the Department of Commerce has one of the largest numbers, or is the largest number of pages dedicated to its jurisdiction. About almost 3,000 pages. There are 112 chapters, 54 chapters of rules. And we looked at condensing and trying to figure out ways in which we could consolidate, repeal, or keep things streamlined in government. And all, as you know, this is all part of the governor's effort to streamline, improve, simplify. And what is remarkable about this bill, even though it's slimmed down to a few provisions, is this was what was fun about this was that I was in my office one day and somebody ran in and said, "You've got to be kidding me. We still regulate the telegraph industry, and we don't know of too many places, maybe perhaps somewhere in Canada." You know, on the House side, they thought perhaps out in Chaska, which is where I grew up, but I doubt it. But we've slimmed it down. These are non-controversial items, as far as we know. And then there's the multi-party line telephone service provision. All of these are obsolete and unnecessary. So with that, I just turn it over. I want to thank the committee again. And, again, this will get all wrapped up in the governor's on-session proposals and on to the next thing. So.
Yeah. Thank you. And any questions at all for the commissioner or Senator Sparks here? Okay, seeing none, thanks again. And is there any more testimony?
That's all that I have, Mr. Chair.
Okay. So with that, Senator Sparks moves that Senate File 2440, as amended, be recommended to pass. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Motion prevails. The bill is passed. And Senator Sparks, Senate File 2617.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members, and we'll keep on with this on-session theme. Senate, which one are we on, 2617?
Yes.
Okay. That's Economic Development, Obsolete and Redundant Laws Repeals. Represents the Department of Employment Economic Development's work to clean up their statutes they operate under. I also have an author's amendment on this bill as well, Mr. Chair, the A1 amendment that I'd like to offer at this time.
Okay. Senator Sparks moves the A1 amendment to get it in the shape and form that he would like. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed? Motion prevails. Bill is amended. And Senator Sparks to the bill as amended.
It's 5 o'clock again. I think I'll just turn over to Ms. Babine to run through the bill for you.
Okay. And Ms. Babine, welcome to the committee. And state your name for the record, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. My name is Kim Babine. I am the Director of Government Affairs for DEED. And regrets from the commissioner. She was hoping to be here today, and she was unable to. So she sends her regards. Before you have the department's on-session statute reduction bill, and much like the Department of Commerce, we went through every line, every page of our statutes looking for anything that we might be able to do to simplify the statutes that govern DEED and our work, simplify, eliminate things that aren't being used anymore. Maybe there were statutes that were good and were put in place and were good at the time, and we've improved upon those now and have different ways of dealing with different issues now. So we took a look at those programs and lifted those out of the bill. So we looked at things that were obsolete, didn't have funding or been replaced by other newer programs. The one piece that I would like to highlight is in Section 2 is the UI record retention provision. This section reduces the wage detail record-keeping requirements for businesses. Currently, the state of Minnesota requires that businesses keep their wage records for 8 years, and the federal government only requires 4 years. So we are going to be in line with the federal government and other states. We were the highest in the nation. We were requiring people to keep those records for much longer. So this is going to help every single business and employer in the state. So we're pretty excited about that one. Other than that, happy to answer any questions on any of the specifics.
Thank you. Any questions? Yes, Senator Bonoff.
Mr. Chair, Ms. Babine, Senator Sparks, the repealers are pretty comprehensive. Mm-hmm. And so that concerns me to see such significant repealers. Mm-hmm. So, for example, 3.33, Minnesota Entrepreneur Resource Virtual Network. That was my bill. I liked it.
I didn't repeal that one.
I've been wondering about it, in fact. It was a one-stop shop that we were to have everything that an employer needed to do to comply with Minnesota statutes in one place. And actually, the Chamber of Commerce said they were going to help us with developing it. And I've been thinking, you know, a thought will pop into my mind, whatever happened with that darn thing? And so I don't know what happened to it, but I don't so when we did our unsession bill, Senator Sparks, and every committee does things differently, we said that we weren't going to repeal anything that actually was a policy change because we thought that deserved the you know, the legislative thought process. And so to see something like that just deleted rather than really having that discussion, I don't know. The Science and Technology Economic Development Project, I know we stopped funding the Science and Technology Authority. Is that what that is? Environmental Coordinations Procedures Act, that seems important to have all that. So you're getting the drift.
Yep.
If you, okay.
Okay, and Ms. Babine.
Mr. Chair, Senator Bonoff, thank you for bringing that up, and I am happy. Hopefully you have in your packet, maybe you don't. We have explanations.
No.
We have an explanation for each repealer, and I'm happy to go through each of them to let you know the status of those pieces that you mentioned. For instance, the Minnesota Entrepreneur Resource Virtual Network, MERVIN, you will be happy to know, is in great shape and is in. It has been replaced by the online business portal that the department, that Minute Services, is undertaking. And so as they develop new access points in the state portal, one of the first projects that they're focused on is the online business portal, which will be exactly what you are referring to. So that, along with other e-government work that has been going on and is currently taking place. So the statute, you were, some of these, especially this one, is a good example, Mr. Chair, Senator Bonoff, that of things that were really important to put into statute to spur the growth and to make sure things happen, and now they're happening. And this isn't governing the online business portal. The online business portal is the way that the state is combating that problem or addressing that issue. I'm happy to go through these one by one, Mr. Chair, Senator Bonoff. The Department of Employment and Economic Development is a little bit different than some others, in like Commerce. We are a program-driven agency. We don't have any regulatory control. So the pieces that we focused on are all programs. So we've lifted out entire programs instead of changing a line here or a line there. So I'm happy to go into the details on those other ones.
Senator Bonoff.
Mr. Chair, well, thank you for the explanation on MERVIN. It does kind of calm my... the Science and Technology Economic Development Project, you know, it was disappointing when we lost a really outstanding person who was leading the Science and Technology Authority. When we stopped funding it, she went to another state. And I think that, you know, I would have preferred that we kept funding it. And so my concern about... You know, it says none of these are currently active and there is no leftover funding. I got that. But sometimes if we leave it in law, then it, I mean, where's the historical perspective? I see what you're saying. I don't know, members. I mean, is it better to just delete it or show it as something that exists unfunded?
Mr. Chair, Senator Bonoff, I hear your concern, and we grappled with the same thing. It's a policy decision. Do you leave things that are unfunded or maybe are not in use anymore? Do you leave those on the books, or do you for that historical record, or moving forward, do we have only programs that are active? And the administration made a policy decision. The department also made a policy decision that because nothing ever goes away. We have everything, not only in the books, but also online and easily accessible, that if they were not being funded at the current time, then we would take them off. And some of them are fine programs that are would be great if they were funded right now. A lot of them, for that historical perspective, if you were going to fund them in the future, maybe there's a new way to look at it instead of having language from a couple years back. Maybe you use that as a base and then have new language. So it is definitely a policy decision, but you'll see that throughout our list.
Thank you.
Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a few as well that mm-hmm. I think are important, and that would be three on your list, which is the Rural Policy and Development Center Fund, mm-hmm. And number four, Science and Technology Economic Development Project, and number nine, the Biomedical Innovation and Commercialization Initiative. Mm-hmm. And a couple comments. It's much easier. Well, one, I support the streamlining effort. I think that's much needed. And usually I think departments do that every year. They bring their department bills that take out all the obsolete language. And so I appreciate that we're really focused on that. But I also know that if there's something, it's much easier to secure funding for a program that already exists rather than needing to establish the program and the funding. That's a much harder sale, so to speak. And I'll give you an example of what we did in tax committee last week. As we rolled out our tax omnibus bill, there was a repealer that was going to have something to do with some aggregate tax type of thing. And it was going to be repealed because all 87 counties have opted out of that particular thing, and there was no need for it anymore. But I think it was Senator Bach's suggestion, I think it was his amendment, to leave that in, because we don't know what we're going to need in the future in that regard. And so I would like to suggest then, I'd like to list, I've read the dialogue here about those three particular projects, the Rural Policy Development Center Fund, Science, Technology, Economic Development Project, and the Biomedical Innovation and Commercialization Initiative. And let me just say on the last one particularly, it's good that we've got the University of Minnesota working on that, but biomedical innovation and commercialization is a statewide, and we have a lot of wonderful providers and scientists who are developing and finding, whether it be regenerative medicine and being able to regenerate heart valves, your own heart valves, things like that. So I think I would like to actually keep that language in place, because there could be others beyond the University of Minnesota, and it's certainly an initiative that we want to encourage. So please tell me about those three items, and then I might have an amendment for you.
Okay. Ms. Babine.
Mr. Chair, Senator Nelson, thank you so much. I would love to go through. I'll go through them first and then talk a little bit more about kind of our methodology. So the Rural Center and Rural Policy and Development Center Fund is a trust fund that was established in 2002. And the funds were taken out in 2005. And so we had a conversation. This, for those of you who are familiar with this center, the fund is completely separate. It's not their operating funds. They have a separate appropriation from the legislature to continue this great work that they're doing. So had a conversation with the executive director of the center and said, what's your plan for this? What it hasn't been funded in a while. Is it something just that? Would you like to keep it on the books, or is this something that, as we look at all of our statutes, do we want them to reflect things that are currently being funded? And in this case, the executive director agreed that the language could come out, and if they requested funding in the future, then they would come with the language and the appropriation at the same time. The number four, the Science and Technology Economic Development Project. I would be concerned about leaving this one in only because it was the precursor to the Science and Technology Authority. And the legislature repealed the entire Science and Technology Authority, and I think that's some strong the legislature's strong show of where we want this to go. So absolutely, science, technology, regenerative medicine, STEM technologies are all some biomedical, all things that the department are focused on, and we're looking for ways to continue to spur that sort of thing. I don't think this is the best way to go about that. There are other things that we may be able to do within the department, or that there may be new and better ways to achieve that in the future. The Biomedical Innovation and Commercialization Initiative, again, 2001, so it's quite a number of years old, and it was a one-off project. So if I agree that there are great things that can be done in this space, and it's not just the University of Minnesota who should be concerned about this. If it were to be funded in the future, again, I would suggest that, if you were writing a bill, that you would go back and look to see what was done in 2001. But I think 13 years later, there will be new ways of approaching this problem to have state involvement. And I would think that we would want to make sure that we have up-to-date language to go with an appropriation.
Thank you. Mr. Chair.
Senator Nelson.
I appreciate the description, and certainly you've answered my questions regarding number three, which is the Rural Policy mm-hmm. and Development Center Fund. I understand that. I'm glad mm-hmm. that good work is going to continue. Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair, I'd like to offer an amendment.
Sure.
Which would be, I'm not sure where it is in the bill, but what I'd like to do is retain item four, the Science and Technology Economic Development Fund Development Project, and number nine, the Biomedical Innovation and Commercialization Initiative. I think it would help us to have those in law, and as we see that and want to amend that, we certainly know how to do that. So that would be my amendment, and maybe Mr. Fuller can give us the exact spot where that is.
And Mr. Fuller.
Senator Nelson moves to delete lines 3.31 and 3.32, science and technology, and to delete page 4, lines 7 and 8, and then to renumber the subdivisions in order.
Okay.
Thank you.
Well, Mr. Chair and members, I would just say that thank you. And I mean, we didn't mean to go too fast. Obviously, this is important stuff, and I was just because of the late hour. But we did have several meetings with the commissioner on this, talked about these very issues. I think, you know, obviously it's a policy decision. We included Senator Dames on one of the last meetings as a Republican lead. I think we just have to make a decision as a committee then as whether or not we want to keep old obsolete laws on the books or if we don't. But that's certainly something, I guess, that's up to the will of the committee. And if these programs haven't been funded since 2001, I don't know if that's a huge issue or not. But I'll certainly listen to what Senator Bonhoff and Senator Nelson have to say.
Senator Bonhoff.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Sparks, you know, I'm sorry if I didn't take the time earlier to go through it and would have talked to you. The Science and Technology Authority, when it got unfunded and got repealed, was very contentious, and there were actually two competing groups at the legislature, and they were outside stakeholder groups, and I still have constituents who come to tell me how bitter they are as to how all that went down. So actually, on that case, I'm not ready to just take it off the books. So I would prefer we didn't. And with regard to the other one, the biomedical innovation, and, for example, what we talked about in our committee around the new regenerative research and are pushing the collaboration of these various groups that are working to work harder together, there might just be a germ of framework within that that could be still used. And so that's why if you – you know, wouldn't object if we could just not delete those two.
Senator Sparks.
Mr. Chair, that's fine.
Okay.
Thank you.
So, considered a friendly amendment. So, any further discussion on the amendment? Okay. All those in favor, Senator Nelson moves the
yes.
oral amendment. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 All opposed? Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. So, Senator Bonhoff.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This one is familiar, but if you could refresh my memory, Senator Sparks or Ms. Babine, why we're repealing the Higher Education Loan Program.
Ms. Babine.
Mr. Chair, Senator Bonoff, yes, this is one that people have probably heard a little bit about, but this loan program itself is not active, and we what I learned through this process is that the Job Skills Partnership is providing this information, or these programs, and it shows up in like the Healthcare and Human Services Worker Program, that the Job Skills Partnership is able to fund these types of initiatives or things that HIRE was trying to get to. So they're able to provide this type of assistance, and the HIRE Education Loan Program is not being used.
Senator Bonoff.
Mr. Chair, so I know that I thought it was hired with a D, but perhaps mm-hmm. it's HIRE. That organization that performs as an outside group some of our Job Skills Partnership and Workforce Development Funds, that's a program they were servicing. Is that what you're saying?
Mr. Chair, Senator Bonoff, great question. Two different things. This HIRE Education Loan Program is one thing. HIRED with a D is a nonprofit organization that provides, that contracts with the department and provides job services in our workforce centers across the state. So two different things.
So, Senator Mr. Bonoff. Chair, so Ms. Babine, so what was the HIRE Education Loan Program?
It was.
Ms. Babine.
Mr. Chair, Senator Bonoff, it was, I don't have a lot more detail than what's in the law. So let me find it.
And perhaps, Senator Bonoff. Mr. Chair, perhaps counsel might have some knowledge of that. Mr. Fuller?
Mr. Fuller?
Mr. Chair, it says the
Ms. Babine.
Board may make loans to Minnesota employers to train persons for jobs in Minnesota, so the loans would then go to the employer. So it's from the Job Skills Partnership Board directly to employers for trainings. The board now, Mr. Chair, Senator Bonoff, the board typically makes grant awards, so I'm guessing the loan program itself is no longer active and utilized because of the grant form or grant structure.
Is there activity in the program?
No activity, Mr. Chair.
No activity. So, any further questions? Okay. Any further testimony at all? Seeing none, Senator Sparks, any final comments? Or
No, thank you. Thank you for the discussion. I appreciate it. Obviously, appreciate the committee's work. I would just move that Senate File 2617 as amended be recommended.
Okay. Senator Sparks moves that Senate File 2617 be recommended to pass. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 All opposed? Motion prevails, and the bill is passed. So thanks, Ms. Babine. Next, we have Senate File 2618.
Thank you, Mr. Senator Chair Sparks. And members, and this will be the final bill. Senate File 2618 deals with the Agriculture Department obsolete and redundant laws removal. Committee members, Senate File 2618, as I stated, represents the Department of Ag's work to clean up their statutes they operate under. I believe we have agreement from all the stakeholder groups on the content of this bill. Santo Cruz from the department is here, and I think I'll turn it over to him again just to talk about what they plan on doing.
Okay, and Mr. Cruz, if you could state your name for the record, please.
Santo Cruz, MDA. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Senator Sparks, for carrying this bill. I would just echo what you've heard from the other agencies in the effort that went into finding the either redundant or obsolete laws that we have found. In honesty, if you can look through what we have here, we do not have a big, bulky bill. Our statutes were actually pretty clean. And so we were able to combine statutes in some cases where there was redundancy. And
the vast majority of what we're taking out as far as pages is really because what was there has been superseded by either, in one case, federal milk orders or in another, federal compact on pest control. So rather than go through line by line, I would stand for questions. I will echo what Senator Sparks said. All of our provisions have been fully vetted, and we do feel very confident that what we've put forth today has broad consensus and lacks any type of controversy that we're aware of. So I'll stand for questions, and thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Thank you. Any questions? Senator Weber.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just quickly, I don't know that it's an issue. I just was wondering. I see that there was warehouse law enforcement authority went from the Department of Ag to the Department of Commerce. Any particular reason for that?
Mr. Schultz. Cruz.
Mr. Chair and Senator, actually, that was changed, and that's one thing that we're going to need to amend. I didn't do a good enough job of making sure that amendment made it over to this side of the building. The reason why that changed and why that will not be moving is because we had vetted it with the Department of Commerce to some degree, but when they got into the nitty-gritty of how the program is run, they wanted to look into it a little further. Currently, we do fulfill that function. The program does pay for itself, and so we have an amendment that we'll be putting forth to basically keep that where it's at. The original thought, Senator, was that it was a little bit more like insurance and bonding, and so maybe it made more sense to do that at Commerce rather than to do that at the Department of Agriculture. But it was something we remained open-minded on. We offered it up, and Commerce said, you know, thanks, but no thanks, and we were okay with that.
Yes, well, it had been suggested to me that we could just delete Article 2.
Yes.
That would be acceptable.
Mr. Chair, that would be appreciated. Thank you.
Okay. So somebody want to move?
Mr. Chair, do you want to do that right now?
Yeah, we can, sure.
So,
that's clear. Just so members know, I mean, we can certainly do that, too, because that's fine if it helps clean it up. But I want just members to be able to hear all the unsessioned bills today, and then we do just plan to lay this bill on the table because we still have a couple of ag issues that we're still working on. But if you want to take it out right now, Senator Weber, I'm fine with that.
Okay. That's fine.
Senator Weber?
Yep.
We'll move to delete Article 2. Any discussion on the oral amendment? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed? Motion prevails. And amendment is adopted. Senator Bonoff.
Mr. Chair, and I have no idea if this is in the bill, but given I represent a suburban district, I don't have many ag issues, but I do have one ag issue that comes up all the time, and so I want to make sure it's not buried in some repealer here. My cities have relationships with other cities to do inspections for them, and they fight with the state who tries to limit their ability to do those joint powers agreements. The state from time to time has tried to come in and say, no, we will do those inspections. And it's really important, for example, Minnetonka does the Wayzata inspections. Wayzata is bigger, but Minnetonka has that expertise. Minnetonka also does the St. Louis Park inspections. Is there anything in this repealer that would take out the ability of those joint powers inspections to occur?
Mr. Cruz.
Mr. Chair and Senator Bonhoff, the short answer is no. But to part of a little bit of context, I think what you're referring to is delegations of authority on food inspection and compliance agreements.
Thank you.
Originally, there was 13 of those that happened, I want to say, 6-7 years ago. In that time, of the original 13 delegations of authority, either 4 or 5 have come back and said, we don't want to do this anymore, and they give it back to the Department of Agriculture. Others have been taken back for cause. So there's a little bit more history to the idea of delegations of authority that does live within the executive branch at the state level, but certainly there are cities that carry that out. But again, the short answer is no, we're not touching that issue here today.
Mr. Chair, I'm familiar with those issues, and I'm grateful that they're not in this bill. Thank you.
Thank you. Any further questions? Okay, seeing none. Senator Sparks, moves that Senate File 2618 be laid over for consideration for action on Wednesday. Is that correct?
That's correct.
For all bills. So all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. All opposed? Motion prevails, and the bill will be laid over. So.
Mr. Chair and members.
And that concludes our business for today. So the meeting is adjourned.